Welcome, listeners, to the NK News Podcast, recorded here in Seoul on Thursday, May 9th, 2019. Joining me here in the studio today is my special guest, Dr. Ki B. Park, Doctor of Medicine. He's the Director of the North Korea Program at the Korean American Medical Association. He has led collaboration between U.S. and North Korean physicians since 2007, so already 12 years. He's made around 20 visits to the DPRK, most recently just last week. His academic interests include DPRK public health and the role of international organizations, factors influencing humanitarian aid, and the relationships between international security, health, and human rights. He's a member of the National Committee on North Korea and the North Korea Committee at the Council of Korean Americans. He is the Paul Farmer Global Security Surgery Scholar at Harvard Medical School and a consultant with the Emergency and Essential Surgical Care Program at the World Healthcare at the World Health Organization. Thank you very much for joining me today, Dr. Park.
It's a pleasure for me to be here, Jacko.
So in October last year, you wrote, together with Eliana Kim, an article called The Case for Funding the UN's Request for Humanitarian Assistance to the DPRK, which can be read at the website of 38 North. And in this article, you cite the urgent call by the United Nations in May last year for humanitarian assistance to the DPRK. Specifically, the call was for $111 million to take care of the food, health, and sanitation needs of the country's 6 million most vulnerable, including 1.7 million children under the age of 5 and more than 340,000 pregnant and breastfeeding women. Ultimately, however, only 21% of that target was met. Why is this?
Well, yeah. Why is that? This is the real question, right? Humanitarian needs, wherever they may exist, we have a responsibility to fulfill them. And the principle is based on need only. It should always be neutral and impartial, and politics should never enter into that decision-making process. However, it does. In the case of North Korea, politics, geopolitics, have played a role in cutting away and chipping away at an international assistance to North Korean people. It is because of the maximum pressure campaign led by the U.S. and Japan that results in the U.N. sanctions. Of course, the U.N. sanctions are from the Security Council. It's multilateral. But there are other measures, unilateral sanctions that involves U.S. Treasury, and also political pressure. U.S. Has a fair amount of political power globally. And they have been very successful in convincing their allies to cut off funding for humanitarian assistance. For example, UK has cut off all of their humanitarian assistance to North Korea, Malaysia, New Zealand, to a point where, and we're sitting here in Seoul. ROK is a donor country. They gave $42 million to World Food Program just last year. But the countries designated to benefit do not include North Korea. If you go back just a little bit to September of 2017, yeah, you may remember that the Moon Jae-in administration announced that they're going to allocate $8 million to the World Food Program, mm-hmm, and UNICEF. And I heard that news. I was elated. But to this day, that money has not been transferred to the agencies.
What reason does the South Korean government give for that? What's the holdup?
They've been incredibly silent when it comes to humanitarian aid to North Korea. I think civil society is much more vocal, but the government, I don't see them speaking out. And I don't think they give a reason, official reason, but I would have to say it's because they want to be coordinated with the U.S. policies. So they've subjugated their desire to help the North Korean people across the DMZ to be more in alignment with the U.S. policies.
Well, that's certainly in line with what Professor Moon Jong-in said yesterday. I had an interview for the podcast with Professor Moon yesterday, and he said almost exactly that, which you're saying, that it's in an effort to align with U.S. policy and not to fall afoul of sanctions regimes. But it's my understanding that there are carve-outs in the sanctions for humanitarian things and for sustenance of life. So how, especially after last year with, you know, all the talks and the hugging between Moon and Kim, how the South Korean government can claim that on the one hand we want to explore the limits of North-South Korean economic cooperation within the current sanctions regime, but at the same time, they're not even coming up with the $8 million of humanitarian aid. I don't know how that works. It just seems to me like they're not trying hard enough, like they could if they wanted to, couldn't they?
So you bring up a very important point, and that is the discordance in the ROK's policies when it comes to North Korea. On one hand, they are saying, let's improve our relations. Even talk about economic cooperations, massive infrastructural projects like the inter-Korea railways. However, on the other hand, they're complicit in denying humanitarian assistance. And so from the North Korean perspective, it's hard to understand what the true intentions are, because you're coming at it saying, let's get this, become friends. Let's work together. On the other hand, well, we're not going to help you even when things are desperate.
But what I find interesting is that then when North Korea does criticize the South Korean government or President Moon, you know, I haven't read all of the words of their media, but it seems to me that the focus of North Korean criticisms is not you didn't give the aid that you promised. The focus is, we need sanctions relief and you've got to push America to get us sanctions relief so that we can do business and have our economy grow. Why is it that North Korea doesn't focus more on basically, you know, the free gift of humanitarian aid that was promised?
Right. So it's everybody sees the focus of the North Korean regime on the economic development. They've said it multiple times, and it's their top priority, isn't it? Economic development. I don't think they're focusing on humanitarian assistance as a national policy per se. I think it's a need, but I don't think they're linking that to overall sanctions relief. The North Koreans are first to point out that the sanctions were never intended to hurt the ordinary people of North Korea, but they do. I just want to go back a little bit on what you mentioned about these carve outs that are in these sanctions. You're absolutely right. In the 90s, the UN applied sanctions on Iraq that included the financial and economic measures. Now, some studies have shown that up to as many as 250,000 children, Iraqi children, may have died as a result of this international sanctions. Because of that experience, safeguards have been placed into the UN sanctions mechanism. For instance, there should be a pre-sanction humanitarian assessment and ongoing sanctions impact assessment. None of these recommendations are followed with the current the sanctions regime against the DPR Korea. Now they're starting to change a little bit because civil society and other public health advocates have spoken out and said, including UN agencies, of course, and saying, listen, these sanctions are completely shutting down our operations, ability to gather funding for our activities, and it is hurting the ordinary people of North Korea. So these carve-outs are there, but they're in there with words only. Mm-hmm. From an operational and functional standpoint, they're completely against the spirit of these exemptions.
But it would be difficult, I think, to do the, you mentioned, pre-sanctions checks. And during the sanctions checks, it would be difficult to do any of those things when North Korea doesn't usually grant access to any kind of organization to do that kind of research.
So we have UN agencies that are in country, the UNICEF, World Food Program. So there's actually six agencies, I believe, that are actually inside North Korea. They're capable of producing these assessments. And in fact, they did. Most recently, the Food and Agricultural Organization and the World Food Program, they did a joint rapid assessment and confirm that the food situation is quite dire. So these things, are ongoing assessments, are absolutely essential to understand the impact on the ordinary people of North Korea.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. So last month, the World Food Program and the Food and Agricultural Organization released another call for emergency assistance to North Korea in terms of food aid. What's been the response so far?
So I, as you know, I was in North Korea last week, and when I arrived in Seoul, on the bus from the airport, there was the report about the conversation between President Moon Jae-in and President Trump.
Right, they had a 35-minute phone call or something like that.
Yeah, and I was incredibly thrilled to hear both of them talking about food aid to North Korea. There's been more talk of it. I understand that Special Representative Biegun is here at the moment. And I think the main topic of discussion, I mean, among others, one of the topics is about coordinating humanitarian assistance. I think finally there's some talk of it. Now, question is whether or not that translates to actual improvement in funding and operations. That remains to be seen.
I put in a request to the U.S. Embassy here for an interview with Steve Biegun and was told that he will not be doing any media during this trip. So maybe next time.
Good luck.
Thank you. Now, there are two main objections that are usually raised when it comes to donating money or any kind of assistance to North Korea. One of them is diversion, and the other one is replacement. Could you walk us through these two objections and what they mean and how you respond to them?
Right. So if you even just recently, there are people in the U.S. government who said, why are we giving aid to North Korea? It will only prop up the regime. And these are valid concerns. But let's analyze it. Let's just talk about diversion. I think in the 1990s, when the UN agencies went in there after the big famine, with the influx of all the humanitarian aid, there was some diversion, as I understand it. This is based on what's been written.
So diversion means basically assets and money being taken away from actual humanitarian assistance and being moved into either feeding the army or helping the military somehow. Is that correct?
Right. Diversion just means that it's not the goods or the resources are not going to where they're intended. Question is whether it's a systematic large-scale diversion where the government diverts large amounts of goods, or whether or not it's happening at a lower level, at the distribution level, right? And then I argue on my article on 38 North that there has been no evidence as of late that there is any kind of large-scale diversion. I'll give you an example. Most of the humanitarian assistance that goes into North Korea, the materials, are purchased outside the country. 90% of the money spent outside and then brought in. So if there's no large-scale diversion, then the diversion at worst would occur at the distribution level. So we're talking about, let's say, food that gets diverted and then it gets sold in country. How would that help? First of all, would it actually end up in the coffers of the regime? And then whether or not that would actually go into helping build their weapons program. So we did a calculation where worst case scenario. So we have this very blunt number, perhaps as much as 30% of international assistance is diverted. Now, there's no evidence of it in Pyongyang.
But that's just a number, like a conceptual number that you've come up with as this could be a worst case scenario.
Right. So to sort of quell the critics, right? So we chose a fairly high percentage. Yeah. 30% is high, although there's no evidence of it, but people quote this number regularly.
Okay. So it is a number going around.
Yeah. Well, international development community. Maybe as 30% of assistance could be diverted. This is a generalized comment, not specifics to the DPR Korea. Ah. So we used the 111 million, which is the amount that the UN resident coordinator had requested. So if we apply that, it's 30% of 111 million, what, 30 million plus, right? If you look at the North Korea's military budget, it's somewhere in the $8 billion a year range.
Right.
Their nuclear program could be between $1 to $2 billion a year. So what are we, you know, if it's diverted at $30 million, could that really significantly impact their will to continue with their military development? No, it's too little. But what's important to remember is that the $111 million, which is not a huge amount of money, is intended to help the most marginalized and the vulnerable population, 6 million people throughout the country's provinces. So we argue that the benefit, potential risk of diversion is minimal, and the impact, social impact, the lifeline of these people is huge.
Okay, now what about then, so that's diversion. The other one is replacement, that If North Korea if the North Korean state receives humanitarian assistance, then it can use resources that it would otherwise have to spend on those vulnerable people. It can use them elsewhere.
I think the word they use is fungibility.
Fungibility, right? Because money is you know, it's like a balloon. You squeeze one end, and the air goes into the other side, right? So money can be moved around.
Right. So let me walk you through that thought process, and then I'll come back and then sort of touch back on whether or not external pressures actually have any impact on domestic pressures, North Korea or elsewhere. So we can talk about that a little bit later. So they argue, hey, if we're providing food and then North Korean government doesn't have to provide that food, right? When we look deeper onto this issue, we found that the North Korean regime actually responds to humanitarian crises when they're acute. For example, when there were the floods in the northeast a couple of years ago, they mobilized 100,000 troops, civilians, to help reconstruct the homes, mm-hmm. and they gave out temporary provisions for the displaced people.
Right.
They have a mechanism in place to help in cases of acute disasters. So let's talk about now more of a chronic humanitarian condition, things like that, you know, malnutrition, basic medical needs, and clean water. They have a different threshold than what the UN agencies use. It's a socialist state, and they're able to provide free education, free medical care, a public distribution system. They have their own set of priorities, and they are doing as much as I think they feel that they can. And you know, if you talk to the North Korean government officials, first thing they'll tell you is, Dr. Park, we're in a state of war. National security is number one priority for us. And I get that. This is how they think. So it gives you a window into how they prioritize their spending. Having said that, so they allocate some of their budget to the social welfare of the people. If you look at the health spending, it has actually gone up as a percentage of GDP, and these numbers could be debatable, but it has actually gone up over the last 10 years during the entire weapons program. So when people say the regime has abandoned the needs of their people for the sake of national security, I don't think that's completely true. I think they are doing as best as they can to provide for their people. I was just in Pyongyang last week, and I saw that Pyongyang Medical College they had renovated the entire operating room suites. It was really antiquated, and now it's fairly up to date. They are spending money on things that are important to the lay people, but the threshold is they're doing as much as they can, but it's not enough. And this is where the UN agencies come in. It provides benefit and lifeline to people that are marginalized that probably wouldn't get the benefit currently, even if it wouldn't change the behavior of the North Korean regime at this point to divert more resources into that particular population. I think they're doing as much as they can, but their threshold is reached. But then there's still people who are still hungry, still need clean water and basic medical care, and that's where the UN agencies come in.
Okay, now some people would argue that. Go on.
Oh, so I wanted to circle back on this idea of withholding aid so that the government will divert more resources to the needs of their people. I just want to illustrate one example. Let's say USA. The cost of healthcare is the number one cost for bankruptcy in the United States. Why don't we divert more of our resources, for instance, from military spending to providing a lower cost healthcare for the people? Well, US doesn't do that, right? They have their own sets of policies. Education is so expensive. Why doesn't the U.S. provide a lower cost education or subsidize it? They don't. So here's an example where the social welfare of the people are impacted. And then will external pressure make the U.S. change their behavior? Highly unlikely. And for the same reason, I don't find that the idea that we try to pressure a regime like the North Korean regime to do more for their people, that calculus doesn't work for me.
Now, I have to respond and say that, of course, every analogy is an imperfect one. But here's a reason why I think the comparing it to the U.S. situation may be an imperfect analogy. And that's precisely because the United States has a very deep, inbred ideology of responsibility for self and choice for one's own, the right to make one's own choices for one's own future. So when it comes to health and education in the United States, you will find there's a large number of people, not only the Republicans, but especially the Republicans, who would argue that everyone is responsible for their own choices. And if you can't pay for your own medical care, well, that's on you. You know, and if you can't choose to go to a better school, then you have to go to whatever the state can provide. The state should be a fallback, not not the large provider. Now, I'm aware that not everyone in America agrees with it, but the point being that North Korea is purely a single sort of a monolithic state in which the state says, we will provide free healthcare to everybody. That's a fundamental. We will provide free education to everybody. That's a fundamental. So the United States and North Korea are very different starting points when talking about healthcare and education. It makes more sense to argue that North Korea should be diverting money towards healthcare and education from the military, whereas the United States, that argument doesn't really hold water because not everyone thinks that way.
Your point is valid. It's an imperfect analogy. I think that the point I was trying to make was that how effective external pressure in changing domestic policies.
Okay, that's an interesting point. But let's go on to some people would argue that on the one hand, we have to help the people of North Korea because they're essentially held captive by their own state. You know, they're kind of like hostages held captive by the Kim Jong-un regime. Other people would say, well, no, actually, North Koreans support their state, so that's exactly why we shouldn't. You know, they've made their choice. They've supported their regime. It stood the test of time for 70 years, so we shouldn't go in there and meddle by giving humanitarian aid. How do you respond to either of those two?
I think we have to go back to what are the humanitarian conditions on the ground for ordinary people. And if we recognize that people are malnourished, which sets them up for additional health problems, where if we recognize that due to lack of clean water, babies are dying of diarrheal diseases, or if we recognize that due to lack of antibiotics, people are unnecessarily dying of infections, then we have to do something because we're in a position to help and we should be.
All right. In another recent piece for 38 North, you wrote that the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria ended its work in North Korea in June last year, and you criticized that. Why was that decision made by the Global Fund?
So the Global Fund, as you know, it's a granting organization. Mm-hmm. It's a $4 billion a year organization. And their aim is to end HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And they've been highly successful. If you look at the mortality rates for those diseases in the developing world, it's been plummeting. They went into North Korea 10 years ago, and then they started two programs, one on tuberculosis and one on malaria. Globally, it's a $4 billion a year.
Yeah, right.
So almost all of that is grants. And it's I just want to take a little comment that a third of that money comes from the U.S. government, mostly, and some from Japan. So they went into North Korea 10 years ago, and they've had one of the best results as far as reduction of mortality from tuberculosis. They have about 110,000 people currently on medications for tuberculosis, and it's their lifeline. In February of last year, a Global Fund updates their website on DPRK, country website, saying they have decided to close the grants as of June 30th due to unique operating conditions. They cannot assure their board on the allocation of the resources and effectiveness of their grants.
So it sounds like they're referring back to diversion and replacement.
Yeah, resource allocation, diversion, and effectiveness of their grants. And that was it was quietly updated on their website. And the public health advocates got a hold of that and saw this is completely crazy. they have patients that are clearly on medications. They need them. And there was no remediation opportunity given. The main recipient, which is UNICEF, and a secondary recipient is WHO. They were never consulted. So this was a very sudden decision. And it kept everybody wondering whether this was a political the pressure, part of the maximum pressure strategy. The Global Fund has denied that. But there have been reports, published reports, that confirm that, in fact, it was pressure from U.S. and Japan that led to that decision. I don't know that for a fact, but I have read that. Now, the decision was curious because if you look at their grant report cards for tuberculosis and malaria, with the exception of the first grant evaluation at the early part of the first 3-year grant, every grant after that, they have performed above or met or above our expectations.
Mm.
So they were performing quite well. So
right.
It was everybody was wondering why this happened. So the Global Fund did stop the grant as of June 30th.
So but it's almost a year now.
Yeah. So they went ahead and then created a buffer stock of drugs, saying we're closing the grant, but we're going to provide extra medication mm-hmm. so that they have some opportunity, some options to replace them,
right.
to give them a little bit of a time cushion. I will tell you that the Global Fund has changed their statement on the DPRK website, on their website. And it is much more optimistic sounding. And there are things like we're looking forward to re-engaging. I think they are actively seeking to re-engage. And then on top of that, with the current mention of humanitarian assistance from the U.S. side, I think this may be the right time to re-engage.
You wrote an open letter to the Global Fund that was published. I saw that. And I know that other voices were calling out for the program to restart and for the Global Fund to reconsider their decision last year. Was there any response apart from the change on the website you just mentioned? Did the Global Fund ever come out and say, look, you know, here's what's going on, or we're sorry, but...
We've never the open letter was published in March. It wasn't direct response to the announcement that was made by Global Fund to close. And we criticized that decision from a public health standpoint because it will create an explosion of the resistant strains of TB, which costs 100 times more to treat. So we criticized it. We contacted the Global Fund. Multiple sources went ahead and contacted the Global Fund. But we were disappointed when they said after their May board meeting that we are going to close the grant. But then we've had subsequent conversations with them. And then it's been much more pro-engagement type of responses. So we're very hopeful that they will go ahead and re-engage.
Okay. Now, you worked out in the paper that you wrote for 38 North, you actually worked out on average how much it costs to treat a tuberculosis patient globally versus how much it costs to treat a patient in North Korea. Was there a big difference?
We specifically wanted to analyze their statement on the effectiveness of their grant claim that they weren't sure.
Mm.
They have their own internal mechanism of evaluating, but we looked at it from a different angle. It's a very simplistic analysis, but we show that their mortality reduction among their peers, the other countries in a similar income level, they have one of the best results of saving lives from tuberculosis.
Wow.
And then we looked at the amount of money that the Global Fund spent per patient in DPR Korea, and we compared that to the amount of money that was spent globally per patient, sort of a worldwide average. And the worldwide average was about $160 per patient.
Mm.
But in North Korea, the Global Fund was getting this high impact for about half that money,
wow.
$80 per patient. So it was it's one of their best performing grants as far as from what we can see.
It's a big difference.
Yeah.
Now, moving on here, in December 2017, you contributed an op-ed to the New York Times in which you stated flatly, 41% of North Koreans, about 10.5 million people, are undernourished, and 28% of children under 5 years old have stunted growth. The hunger is devastating, and it's our fault. When you said it's our fault, who are the our? Is it the United States? Is it the West? Is it the global community? Who are we?
It's the global community, right? We're human beings. We're supposed to help each other. We're all in this together. And when we see people suffering, our duty as a human being is to reach out and say, here, we have extra food. We want you to have it. Or here, we have medical care. The international community has failed to protect the people of North Korea. So it's a collective our fault.
But technically, shouldn't the blame be on the state of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea first?
I'm not saying that the regime has no responsibility. But what I've seen over the last 12 years of working with North Korean doctors and dealing with the patients, the regime is committed to doing what they can to provide for its people. You know, how they allocate their resources, we can all disagree. That they should be different. But I don't think the only reason we can squarely place the blame on the regime. If you look at their why do they have such a huge military budget, right? They say it's 20 to 30% of their annual budget, which is huge. Mm. It's an outlier. But look at the South Korea's military budget. It's a fraction. If you look at the as a proportion of their GDP, it's like 2 or 3%. Mm. In North Korea, it's 20, 30%.
Yeah.
But if you look at the absolute dollars, what that represents, for North Korea, it's maybe $8 billion a year. But South Korea, it's $25 billion a year. People look at North Korea, why are they spending, you know, they don't need to spend all that money on military. If you look at the psyche of the North Korean people, after having gone through the Korean War, where the UN combined forces led by the US, we dropped more ordnance on that small country than we did in the entire World War II Pacific Theater. The bombing was horrendous. Curtis LeMay, I think, he said, I mean, we ran out of military targets and they were bombing civilian targets. The whole country was pulverized. So they have this psyche that they went through this tremendous event, very traumatic event. And I think that still to this day, they want to protect themselves and prevent anything like this from happening ever again. So they have that mentality.
What are the long-term effects of malnutrition and on children throughout the rest of their lives? Is it damage that can be undone?
No. So if you look at the stunting rates, Pyongyang, I think, is 20%, which is huge. But if you go to the rural counties, rural provinces, it could be at 30% or even higher. Stunting represents chronic malnutrition. So if I'm 5'7". When I go to North Korea, I don't feel as short. Mm-hmm. I come to South Korea, I'm definitely one of the shorter people. And I see it. The brain development, the critical time for brain development is under 2 years of age. So when you have malnutrition before 2 years of age, you actually deprive the brain from realizing its full potential. And that has significant implications on the human capital,
yeah.
Right? What happens to these people when they grow up? They're going to perform much lower than what they're capable of doing. That's sort of the human development standpoint. But the other thing is on the health, malnutrition. Without it, you have opportunistic diseases that can take over. Immune system is not as strong. Tuberculosis is a perfect example. You don't see tuberculosis at the rates that we see in North Korea, in South Korea or U.S., and that's because we're not malnourished.
Are you against all economic sanctions on North Korea?
I'm against sanctions that are implemented without any regard to what happens to the people of North Korea, the ordinary people. That's my position. If we're going to apply sanctions, and I understand why the international community wants to do that from a security standpoint, they want to change the North Korea's military behavior. I have no qualms about what they're doing, but let's do what we say we're going to do. Let's practice what we preach, and let's make sure that the people, ordinary people, are innocent people who had no part in this decision process are being impacted and some of them are dying.
You've been going to North Korea now since 2007, back when you began, if I'm correct. The sanctions then were mainly targeting luxury goods, right? So we're talking expensive alcohol, watches, cigars, cheese, these kinds of things. How have you seen the impact of sanctions change over the last 12 years? And did they work back then the way that they were intended to? I mean, were you opposed to the anti-luxury goods sanctions in 2007, or have they basically always affected the little people most?
So the smart sanctions, right, which are supposed to target like the weapons industry and things like that,
yeah.
That makes sense to me, right? But then it changed over the last 2 or 3 years. The sanctions have now moved to economic embargoes, basically, you know, restricting fuel imports,
mm-hmm.
petroleum imports.
So
fuel imports to 10% of previous levels. That's a dramatic decrease. And then export activity has been blocked. For instance, all garment exports, seafood exports, coal exports are now banned. So, yeah, this is an economic embargo. And there's no banking channels now. As you know, it's now even the UN agencies, they used to have a intermediary bank in Russia, but that channel has shut down. So let's talk about this. If you look at the public distribution system,
mm-hmm.
right now the rations are now, I think the are read from the World Food Program, 300 grams per day of food. That's about 2 medium-sized potatoes a day, mm-hmm. and that's it. That's not enough. You're going to be hungry.
But some would argue that most people don't survive on the ration system anymore.
That's correct. So they supplement their food intake through market
markets
purchases. Mm-hmm. But what happens when you have, you know, what is it, 50,000 workers at Kaesong that suddenly lose their jobs? Mm-hmm. The coal industry, the seafood export industry, what happens to all those people that used to perhaps was getting some sort of an income, but now they are not able to get that? How can they afford the food that they were able to afford before? And I'll tell you, for my last visit, I've been in Pyongyang 20 times. I've operated in the Pyongyang University Medical College. That's their main medical school. It's like Yonsei University here, right? It's their top teaching hospital. They managed to keep some of these old medical equipment going, and they were getting parts to repair and things like that. Just this time, when I was there, a key machine is a X-ray machine in the operating room. Now they said we can't fix it and we can't get the parts for it. So these medical devices and equipment, they're unable to get the replacement parts. And I think that's a result of the sanctions. And then fuel restriction. It has to contribute to the cost of food for the ordinary people. I had one patient that I operated on, and he had a kind of a broken neck. It's not exactly broken. He hurt it when he fell, mm-hmm. and it was unstable and needed to be repaired. Now, thankfully, we were able to operate on him, and then now he's fine. Now he's protected. But that happened like 5-6 months ago. The delay to treatment, if you start thinking about what are some of the causes, and you start wondering if the increasing fuel costs and transportation costs contributes to delay in seeking treatment, and that impacts the health of the people.
If the global community takes sanctions off the table, lifted all the sanctions, what leverage would there be remaining to push North Korea to denuclearize short of military attacks?
Well, let me put it this way. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. Now, they might not have the capability to deliver it all the way to continental United States.
And they haven't threatened to. That's important, isn't it?
Right. But we're not also threatening and then flying B-2 bombers over, just, you know, right before their border and turning them around. There aren't behaviors that suggest that we're imminently, ready to attack, and we don't do military exercises in their front yard. So I think your point's well taken, but I think there's two sides to that coin. But Pakistan does possess nuclear weapons. We actually provide assistance to them. We have a diplomatic relationship with them. Why don't we insist that Pakistan get rid of all their nuclear weapons? So the point I'm trying to make is that the North Koreans developed the nuclear weapons because they want to feel secure. If the threat of them using the weapons in a way that disturbs the international community is not there, then is it so bad that they have a nuclear weapon? Can we live with a nuclear North Korea? And can we transform the relationship in such a way that the threat... So we're talking about, can we change the intentionality of the two sides rather than the capabilities? I think we're focusing on, let's take away the capabilities, but that the North Koreans are looking at it, let's work on intentions.
I think that would be a hard sell to the United States Congress. Right? That would be a very, very tough mess. I mean, I can understand your thinking behind it, but I can't see the Republicans or even the White House going along with the idea of let's just live with a North Korea that is nuclear armed, but simply change their intentionality.
So there might be something that the some people in the United States, especially on the Hill, it is a uncomfortable a condition to accept. But in reality, I think the North Koreans, at least from their point of view, they have achieved nuclear capabilities, and I don't think we can't go back. If they have developed it, they demonstrated certain capabilities, and that this is reality. Now, for in the U.S. government to say, hey, now you should give it all up. You have to look at why they've developed the nuclear weapons in the first place. And in the promise of economic development, just words, the U.S. government has lost much in the way of credibility. Look what happened with the Iran deal that fell apart. So we're going to have to do something that's substantial, and it's going to take a lot of time. But one way to do that is to start removing some of the barriers that prevent economic development. What's wrong with starting to develop some kind of a economic cooperation and then bring the North Koreans into the economic, the world standards, right? International standards for banking, certain behaviors that are required. I don't really see a threat in that.
In the last 5 minutes or so, let's talk a bit more about your biannual trips to North Korea and your work with the surgeons and your trip last year. So what's the purpose of the visits, first of all?
So the Korean American Medical Association's program to assist the DPRK physicians, it's to help them improve their ability to care for their patients. And we do that through education and training, research collaboration, conferences, things like that. So we've been going there since 2007. We have licenses to practice in North Korea, and we see the patients, and we work alongside the North Korean colleagues.
So you think the program is having a positive effect?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. So I'm a neurosurgeon by training, and I specialize in spine and spine reconstruction. I'm happy to say over the last 10, 12 years, and we published this, the Pyongyang Medical College Teaching Hospital, they've been able to develop their spine program to a point where the government has recognized it as a center of excellence. They're manufacturing their own spinal implants. Because of the sanctions, they can't buy these things. Now, whether or not that knowledge and skills and capabilities can get out to the provincial hospitals, that's our next challenge, right? Because but Pyongyang Medical College is their centralized teaching hospital, and we hope that the other provinces would benefit.
Now, it can be argued, I mean, of course, healthcare is a noble profession, and it's great what you're doing, but it can also be argued that Pyongyang essentially is a bit like a different country compared to, you know, rural North Korea, right? The provinces out there. For example, I was there just a month ago, and plastic surgery is a thing in Pyongyang, right? There are people who voluntarily pay money to have eye surgery and nose surgery. So there are some resources that are being allocated in plastic surgery when they could probably just as well be put into helping people out in the provinces to recover from injuries or diseases. What do you think of that?
No, it's a valid question. I have seen cases, and I'm not a plastic surgeon, but one of our plastic surgeons from the U.S. traveled with us a couple of years back, and he noticed, and he can see right away who's had surgery and who has not had plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery.
Right. Yeah, I should point out there's a difference between reconstructive plastic surgery and cosmetic plastic surgery, which is entirely a voluntary or optional thing that, you know, I presume North Koreans don't get that for free. I presume that if a North Korean wants to have the double eye fold surgery, they probably have to pay for that.
Yes.
I hope they're not getting that for free.
You're absolutely right. The healthcare system does not provide for cosmetic surgery as far as I know. They are trying to strengthen their plastic surgery reconstruction aspect of it. I saw a presentation by a plastic surgeon using tissue expanders to cover areas where they had to remove significant amount of, let's say, moles or disfigurement. So they're developing and that reconstructive technology. I want to address a little bit on the urban-rural disparity.
Please.
So we get to ask this a lot. So I work at the Harvard Program in Global Surgery and Social Change, and we provide technical assistance to the World Health Organization when they're asked by member states, right, countries, to help in developing their essential and emergency surgical care. And this has to do with county-level hospitals, not main teaching-level hospitals. So these are nationwide programs, improve surgical care at the point of need in the provinces. I will tell you that North Korea, in 2015, there was a resolution at the World Health Assembly in Geneva. And so the member states decide to sign on to certain resolutions. And there was a resolution calling for strengthening of emergency essential care, surgical care and anesthesia as part of universal health coverage. It's interesting because the co-sponsors of that particular resolution includes USA and DPR Korea. And so there are things that the two countries can work together on.
Right.
And this passed unanimously, by the way. Now, just recently, DPR Korea has indicated that they want. They were sponsors and signatories to this resolution. They came back, and then they have a 5-year medium-term strategic health plan for health. And the last one was 2016 to 2020. And they inserted into their national strategic plan provision of WHO emergency essential surgical package at the district hospitals. Now, they're finally getting around to now fleshing that out and saying, let's see what we can do to improve it. And the WHO and the Harvard Group and the Ministry of Public Health in North Korea, we've been discussing exactly this issue. And then we may even start as early as this year and then do an assessment and then moving on with implementation. But as you know, the challenge will be financing such a national project, which could probably cost as much as $500 million.
I want to talk about access to healthcare. Do you see any signs in North Korea that the that there is a form of triage or prioritization for people who are, let's just say, more loyal or with a better background than people who are not? Maybe party members get treatment first, or, you know, do you see any evidence of that?
I think in any country, even in this country, and let's say, when I say this, the South Korea, you know, my colleagues who are neurosurgeons constantly get calls from their friends and saying, hey, I've got a friend and he has this problem. Can you get him in? Can you get him into this doctor? That
sure.
kind of stuff.
But that's on an individual basis. I'm talking about a system. Do you see any systematic form of triage that identifies people according to social rank or status?
So I think there's some of that. First, let me just talk about the referral system. North Korea has a very strong, centralized public health system with referral pathways. There's a section doctor system. So each section doctor is responsible for a finite number of patients. So it's very difficult for people in the North Korean health system to fall through the cracks, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And things get bounced up. And then ultimately, they could end up in Pyongyang for treatment if they need it. Exactly, you know, so that system is in place. Now, I do know within Pyongyang, there are multiple hospitals. And there appears to be some hospitals which are more preferentially used by the elites. But I don't know much about it. I don't have too much information. But there seems to be some kind of, this hospital is for a certain level of, you know, where you are in the government or party or something like that. I think it's there is something to be about that.
Okay. Last question. Where would you like to see North Korea in terms of public health and humanitarian aid in the next 5 to 10 years?
We have a unique opportunity today in 2019. The three leaders are talking, right? Moon Jae-in, Chairman Kim Jong-un, and then President Trump. They're talking, which is an amazing development in of itself. But there's some blocks, barriers that are hindering progress. But why are we waiting? So some people say, you know, we have this clock that, you know, we have time. No, when it comes to humanitarian needs and the ordinary people of North Korea, they don't have time.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see the UN sanctions, the humanitarian exemption, fully accounted for. So when they said, yes, the sanctions should not impact ordinary lives of North Korean people, let's work on that. It's promising that the last panel of experts, a report that was published in March, for the first time had 4 recommendations when it comes to humanitarian impact. Mm-hmm. They recommended an ongoing impact assessment. I think that should be done. Whether or not there's money to do that, I don't know. The other one is creation of a whitelist. Mm-hmm. So as you know, people de-risk themselves. They don't want to get in a file of U.S. Treasury, Sanctions Committee. So if there's any question, they go through an exemption process, which bogs down the system.
Right.
But let's streamline that by having a list of things that are fully vetted, but saying it's okay. You don't have to go through the sanctions process. So there are things that could be done. But what I'd like to see is that humanitarian corridor, while these discussions are happening on security aspect, humanitarian corridor fully expanded and make sure that all the needs that are currently present in DPR Korea are met. And not just the food, clean water, but when you look at humanitarian needs, there's also capacity building. Let's give them support so they can build and strengthen their hospital systems, train their doctors. And I'd like to see that in 5 to 10 years, that they have a very robust system, healthcare system, that can meet all the needs of their people.
Great. Well, I want to thank you again very much for coming on the podcast today, Dr. Park. It was a delight to talk to you. And I hope that we can get you back next year after a couple more visits to North Korea. And you can sort of tell us more about what you've seen there and how things are going. Would you like to do that?
I'll look forward to it.
That'd be great. All right. Thanks very much. Ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, please, to subscribe to our podcast, share it with your friends and colleagues, and also consider subscribing to nknews.org. You can save $50 off your subscription by using the code podcast at the checkout, and one lucky reviewer per week will be chosen for a free annual subscription to NK News. Just review us at iTunes or wherever else you listen to the podcast. Thanks very much, and listen again next time.